consisting largely of seafood and oats made into porridges and cakes. The Eskimos he interviewed lived on raw fish, game meat, fish roe, and blubber, seldom eating anything remotely green. Along the Nile near Ethiopia, Price encountered what he judged to be the healthiest populations of all. Tribes that drank milk and blood from pastured cattle and ate meat as well as animal food from the Nile River. Price found groups that ate diets of wild animal flesh to be generally healthier than the agriculturists who relied on cereals and other plant foods. The agriculturists tended to have somewhat higher levels of tooth decay, though still low by modern standards. Price noted that many of the peoples he visited particularly prized organ meats, in which he found high levels of fat-soluble vitamins, minerals, and Activator X, a term of his own invention that is probably vitamin K2. Almost everywhere he went, he noted the high value placed on seafood, which even mountain people would go to great lengths to procure, trading with coastal tribes for dried fish eggs and such. But the common denominator of good health, he concluded, was to eat a traditional diet consisting of fresh foods from animals and plants grown on soils that were themselves rich in nutrients. Price paid special attention to the quality of animal-based foods and its link to what those animals ate. He compared the vitamin content of butter produced from cows grazing on spring grass to that of animals on winter forages. Not only were levels of vitamins A and D much higher in the yellower butter of the pastured animals, but the health of the people who subsisted on those animals was better too. Price believed the quality of the soil was a key to health, and in 1932, he published a paper titled New Light on Some Relationships Between Soil Mineral Deficiencies, Low Vitamin Foods, and Some Degenerative Diseases. In making such connections between the quality of soil and grass and the health of the human eaters at the top of the food chain, Price was advancing a critique of the industrialized agriculture just getting established in the 30s. In this, he was not alone. Around the same time, the English agronomist Sir Albert Howard, the philosophical father of the organic farming movement, was also arguing that the industrialization of agriculture, in particular, the introduction of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, which simplified the chemistry of the soil, would eventually take its toll on our health. Howard urged that we regard the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and man as one great subject. When Howard wrote these words, this was still little more than a working hypothesis. Weston Price had begun to put some empirical foundations beneath it. Price was inching toward an ecological understanding of diet and health that was well ahead of his time. He understood that ultimately, eating linked us to the earth and its elements, as well as to the energy of the sun. The dinner we have eaten tonight, he told his audience in a 1928 lecture, was a part of the sun but a few months ago. Industrial food both obscured these links and attenuated them. In lengthening the food chain so that we could feed great cities from distant soils, we were breaking the rules of nature at least twice. By robbing nutrients from the soils the foods had been grown in, and then by squandering those nutrients by processing the foods. Compared to the native peoples Price studied, many of whom took pains to return nutrients to the local soil on which they absolutely depended, our modern civilization returns exceedingly little of what it borrows. Vast fleets are busy carrying the limited minerals of far-flung districts to distant markets. Renner documents how Price eventually came to see the problem of diet and health as a problem of ecological dysfunction. By breaking the links among local soils, local foods, and local peoples, the industrial food system disrupted the circular flow of nutrients through the food chain. Whatever the advantages of the new system, it could no longer meet the biochemical requirements of the human body, which, not having had time to adapt, was failing in new ways. But whether or not you're willing to travel quite that far with Dr. Price, he and all the other early 20th century explorers of the pre-Western diet returned to civilization with the same simple and devastating piece of news, one that seems hard to deny. The human animal is adapted to, and apparently can thrive on, an extraordinary range of different diets. But the Western diet, however you define it, does not seem to be one of them. As it happened, the ecological critique of industrial civilization that Weston Price was advancing in the 30s would not survive World War II. The space for such writing, occupied also by Sir Howard and the American agrarians, closed down very shortly after Price published Nutrition and Physical Degeneration in 1939. By then, people had lost their patience for attacks on industrial civilization, that being precisely what they were depending on to save them in wartime. By the time the war ended, that industrial civilization had consolidated its hold and in the process become much more sure of itself. In the years immediately after the war, industrial agriculture, which benefited from the peacetime conversion of munitions to chemical fertilizer and nerve gas research to pesticides, also consolidated its position. There would soon be no other kind. Weston Price and his fellow students of the Western diseases were largely forgotten. No one was much interested in looking back or celebrating the wisdom of primitive groups that were themselves quickly disappearing or being assimilated. Even the Aborigines were moving to the city. As for the Western diseases, they hadn't gone away. Indeed, rates of heart disease exploded immediately after the war. But now they became the responsibility of modern medicines deploying the tools of reductionist science. Nutritionism became the accepted term in which to conduct all conversations about diet and health. It wouldn't be until the late 1960s, with the rise of organic agriculture, that searching questions about the industrial food chain would be asked again. The industrialization of eating, what we do know. I've dwelled on the all-but-forgotten ideas of people like Weston Price and Sir Albert Howard, ecological thinkers about the human food chain, because they point us down a path that might lead the way out of the narrow and ultimately unhelpful confines of nutritionism, of thinking about food strictly in terms of its chemical constituents. What we need now, it seems to me, is to create a broader, more ecological, and more cultural view of food. So let us try. What would happen if we were to start thinking about food as less of a thing and more of a relationship? In nature, that is, of course, precisely what eating has always been. Relationships among species in systems we call food chains or food webs that reach all the way down to the soil. Species co-evolve with the other species that they eat, and very often there develops a relationship of interdependence. I'll feed you if you spread around my genes. A gradual process of mutual adaptation transforms something like an apple or a squash into a nutritious and tasty food for an animal. Over time and through trial and error, the plant becomes tastier and often more conspicuous in order to gratify the animal's needs and desires, while the animal gradually acquires whatever digestive tools, enzymes, for example, it needs to make optimal use of the plant. Similarly, the milk of cows did not start out as a nutritious food for humans. In fact, it made them sick, until people who lived around cows evolved the ability to digest milk as adults. The gene for the production of a milk-digesting enzyme called lactase used to switch off in humans shortly after weaning, until about 5,000 years ago, when a mutation that kept the gene switched on appeared and quickly spread through a population of animal herders in north-central Europe. Why? because the people possessing the new mutation then had access to a terrifically nutritious new food source, and as a consequence were able to produce more offspring than the people who lacked it. This development proved much to the advantage of both the milk drinkers and the cows, whose numbers and habitat and health greatly improved as a result of this new symbiotic relationship. Health is, among other things, the product of being in these sorts of relationships in a food chain. A great many such relationships in the case of an omnivorous creature like man. It follows that when the health of one part of the food chain is disturbed, it can affect all the other creatures in it. If the soil is sick or in some way deficient, so will be the grasses that grow in that soil, and the cattle that eat the grasses, and the people who drink the milk from them. This is precisely what Weston Price and Sir Howard had in mind when they sought to connect the seemingly distant realms of soil and human health. Our personal health cannot be divorced from the health of the entire food web. In many cases, long familiarity between foods and their eaters leads to elaborate systems of communication up and down the food chain, so that a creature's senses come to recognize foods as suitable by their taste and smell and color. Very often these signals are sent by the foods themselves, which may have their own reasons for wanting to be eaten. Ripeness in fruit is often signaled by a distinctive smell. An appealing scent that can travel over distances, or color, one that stands out from the general green, or tastes, typically sweet. Ripeness, which is the moment when the seeds of the plant are ready to go off and germinate, typically coincides with the greatest concentration of nutrients in a fruit, so the interests of the plant, for transportation, align with those of the plant eater, for nutriment. Our bodies, having received these signals and determined this fruit is good to eat, now produce in anticipation precisely the enzymes and acids needed to break it down. Health depends heavily on knowing how to read these biological signals. This looks ripe. This smells spoiled. That's one sick-looking cow. This is much easier to do when you have long experience of a food, and much harder when a food has been expressly designed to deceive your senses, with artificial flavors, say, or synthetic sweeteners. Foods that lie to our senses are one of the most challenging aspects of the Western diet. Note that these ecological relationships are, at least in the first instance, between eaters and whole foods, not nutrients or chemicals. Even though the foods in question eventually get broken down in our bodies into simple chemical compounds, as corn is reduced mostly to simple sugars, the qualities of the whole foods are not unimportant. The amount and structure of the fiber in that corn, for example, will determine such things as the speed at which the sugars in it will be released and absorbed, something we've learned is critical to insulin metabolism. The chemist will tell you the starch in corn is on its way to becoming glucose in the blood, but that reductive understanding overlooks the complex and variable process by which that happens. Contrary to the nutrition label, not all carbohydrates are created equal. Put another way, our bodies have a long-standing and sustainable relationship to corn that they do not have to high-fructose corn syrup. Such a relationship with corn syrup might develop someday as people evolve superhuman insulin systems to cope with regular floods of pure fructose and glucose. But for now, the relationship leads to ill health because our bodies don't know how to handle these biological novelties. Glucose is a sugar molecule that is the body's main source of energy. Most carbohydrates are broken down to glucose during digestion. Fructose is a different form of sugar, commonly found in fruit. Sucrose, or table sugar, is a disaccharide, consisting of a molecule of glucose joined to a molecule of fructose. In much the same way, human bodies that can cope with chewing cocoa leaves, an enduring relationship between native people and the cocoa plants in parts of South America, cannot cope with cocaine or crack, even though the same active ingredients are present in all three. Reductionism as a way of understanding food or drugs may be harmless, even necessary, but reductionism in practice, reducing food or drug plants to their most salient chemical compounds, can lead to problems. Looking at eating and food through this ecological lens opens a whole new perspective on exactly what the Western diet is. A radical and, at least in evolutionary terms, abrupt set of changes over the course of the last 150 years, not just to our foodstuffs, but also to our food relationships, all the way from the soil to the meal. The rise of the ideology of nutritionism is itself part of that change. When we think of a species' environment, we usually think in terms of things like geography, predators and prey, and the weather. But of course, one of the most critical components of any creature's environment is the nature of the food available to it and its relationships to the species it eats. Much is at stake when a creature's food environment changes. The first big change for us came 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture. And it devastated our health, leading to a panoply of deficiency and infectious diseases that we've only managed to get under control in the last century or so. The biggest change in our food environment since then? The advent of the modern diet. To get a better grip on the nature of these changes is to begin to understand how we might alter our relationship to food. For the better. For our health. These changes have been numerous and far-reaching, but consider as a start these five fundamental transformations to our foods and ways of eating. All of them can be reversed, if not perhaps so easily in the food system as a whole, certainly in the life and diet of any individual eater. And without, I hasten to add, returning to the bush or taking up hunting and gathering. From Whole Foods to Refined. The case of corn points to one of the key features of the modern diet. A shift toward increasingly refined foods, especially carbohydrates. People have been refining cereal grains since at least the Industrial Revolution, favoring white flour and white rice over brown, even at the price of lost nutrients. Part of the reason was prestige. Because for many years only the wealthy could afford refined grains, they acquired a certain glamour. Refining grains extends their shelf life, precisely because they are less nutritious to the pests that compete with us for their calories, and makes them easier to digest by removing the fiber that ordinarily slows the release of their sugars. Also, the finer that flour is ground, the more surface area is exposed to digestive enzymes, so the quicker the starches turn to glucose. A great deal of modern industrial food can be seen as an extension and intensification of this practice, as food processors find ways to deliver glucose, the brain's preferred fuel, ever more swiftly and efficiently. Sometimes this is precisely the point, as when corn is refined into corn syrup. Other times, though, it is an unfortunate byproduct of processing food for other reasons. Viewed from this perspective, the history of refining whole foods has been a history of figuring out ways not just to make them more durable and portable, but also how to concentrate their energy and, in a sense, speed them up. This acceleration took a great leap forward with the introduction in Europe around 1870 of rollers, made from iron, steel, or porcelain for grinding grain. Perhaps more than any other single development, this new technology, which by 1880 had replaced grinding by stone throughout Europe and America, marked the beginning of the industrialization of our food, freeing it from the confines of place, reducing it to its chemical essence, and speeding up its absorption. Refined flour is the first fast food. Before the roller milling revolution, wheat was ground between big stone wheels, which could get white flour only so white. That's because while stone grinding removed the bran from the wheat kernel, and therefore the largest portion of the fiber, it couldn't remove the germ, or embryo, which contains volatile oils that are rich in nutrients. The stone wheels merely crushed the germ and released the oil. This had the effect of tinting the flour yellowish-gray. The yellow is carotene, and shortening its shelf life, because the oil, once exposed to the air, soon oxidized, turned rancid. That's what people could see and smell, and they didn't like it. What their senses couldn't tell them, however, is that the germ contributed some of the most valuable nutrients to the flour, including much of its protein, folic acid, and other B vitamins, carotenes and other antioxidants, and omega-3 fatty acids, which are especially prone to rancidity. The advent of rollers that made it possible to remove the germ and then grind the remaining endosperm, the big packet of starch and protein in a seed, exceptionally fine, solved the problem of stability and color. Now just about everyone could afford snowy white flour that could keep on a shelf for many months. No longer did every town need its own mill, because flour could now travel great distances. Plus, it could be ground year-round by large companies in big cities. Heavy stone mills, which typically relied on water power, operated mostly when and where rivers flowed. Steam engines could drive the new rollers whenever and wherever. Thus was one of the main staples of the Western diet cut loose from its moorings in place and time and marketed on the basis of image rather than nutritional value. In this, white flour was a modern industrial food, one of the first. The problem was that this gorgeous white powder was nutritionally worthless, or nearly so. Much the same was now true for corn flour and white rice, the polishing of which, i.e., the removing of its most nutritious parts, was perfected around the same time. Wherever these refining technologies came into widespread use, devastating epidemics of pellagra and beriberi soon followed. Both are diseases caused by deficiencies in the B vitamins that the germ had contributed to the diet. But the sudden absence from bread of several other micronutrients, as well as omega-3 fatty acids, probably also took its toll on public health, particularly among the urban poor of Europe, many of whom ate little but bread. In the 1930s, with the discovery of vitamins, scientists figured out what had happened, and millers began fortifying refined grain with B vitamins. This took care of the most obvious deficiency diseases. More recently, scientists recognized that we also had a deficiency of folic acid in our diet, and in 1996, public health authorities ordered millers to start adding folic acid to flour as well. But it would take longer still for science to realize that this wonder bread strategy of supplementation, as one nutritionist has called it, might not solve all the problems caused by the refining of grain. Deficiency diseases are much easier to trace and treat. Indeed, medicine's success in curing deficiency diseases is an important source of nutritionism's prestige, than chronic diseases, and it turns out that the refining of carbohydrates is implicated in several of these chronic diseases as well, diabetes, heart disease, and certain cancers. The story of refined grain stands as a parable about the limits of reductionist science when applied to something as complex as food. For years now, nutritionists have known that a diet high in whole grains reduces one's risk for diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. This seems to be true even after you correct for the fact that the kind of people who eat lots of whole grains today probably have lifestyles healthier in other ways as well. Different nutritionists have given the credit for the benefits of whole grain to different nutrients. the fiber in the bran, the folic acid and other B vitamins in the germ, or the antioxidants, or the various minerals. In 2003, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition published a strikingly non-reductionist study demonstrating that no one of those nutrients alone can explain the benefits of whole grain foods. The usual reductive analysis of isolated nutrients could not explain the improved health of the whole grain eaters. For the study, University of Minnesota epidemiologists David R. Jacobs and Lynn M. Steffen reviewed the research out there and found a large body of evidence that a diet rich in whole grains did in fact reduce mortality from all causes. But what was surprising was that even after adjusting for levels of dietary fiber, vitamin E, folic acid, phytic acid, iron, zinc, magnesium, and manganese in the diet, all the good things we know are in whole grain, they found an additional health benefit to eating whole grains that none of the nutrients alone or even together could explain. That is, subjects getting the same amounts of these nutrients from other sources were not as healthy as the whole grain eaters. This analysis suggests that something else in the whole grain protects against death. The authors concluded somewhat vaguely but suggestively that the various grains and their parts act synergistically, and suggested that their colleagues begin paying attention to the concept of food synergy. Here, then, is support for an idea revolutionary by the standards of nutritionism. A whole food might be more than the sum of its nutrient parts. Suffice it to say, this proposition has not been enthusiastically embraced by the food industry, and probably won't be anytime soon. As I write, Coca-Cola is introducing vitamin-fortified sodas, extending the Wonder Bread strategy of supplementation to junk food in its purest form. Wonder Soda? The big money has always been in processing foods, not selling them whole, and the industry's investment in a more reductionist approach to food is probably safe. The fact is, there is something in us that loves a refined carbohydrate, and that something is the human brain. The human brain craves carbohydrates reduced to their energy essence, which is to say, pure glucose. Once industry figured out how to transform the seeds of grasses into the chemical equivalent of sugar, there was probably no turning back. And then, of course, there is sugar itself, the ultimate refined carbohydrate, which began flooding the marketplace and the human metabolism around the same time as refined flour. In 1874, England lifted its tariffs on imported sugar. The price dropped by half, and by the end of the 19th century, fully a sixth of the calories in the English diet were coming from beet sugar, with much of the rest coming from refined flour. With the general availability of cheap, pure sugar, the human metabolism now had to contend not only with a constant flood of glucose, but also with more fructose than it had ever before encountered, because sugar, sucrose, is half glucose and half fructose. Fructose is metabolized differently from glucose. The body doesn't respond to it by producing insulin to convey it into cells to be used as energy. Rather, it is metabolized in the liver, which turns it first into glucose and then, if there is no call for glucose, into triglycerides, fat. Per capita, fructose consumption has increased 25% in the past 30 years. In the natural world, fructose is a rare and precious thing, typically encountered seasonally in ripe fruit, when it comes packaged in a whole food full of fiber, which slows its absorption, and valuable micronutrients. It's no wonder we've been hardwired by natural selection to prize sweet foods. Sugar, as it is ordinarily found in nature, in fruits and some vegetables, gives us a slow-release form of energy accompanied by minerals and all sorts of crucial micronutrients we can get nowhere else. Even in honey, the purest form of sugar found in nature, you find some valuable nutrients. One of the most momentous changes in the American diet since 1909, when the USDA first began keeping track, has been the increase in the percentage of calories coming from sugars, from 13% to 20%. Add to that the percentage of calories coming from carbohydrates, roughly 40%, or 10 servings, 9 of which are refined, and Americans are consuming a diet that is at least half sugars in one form or another, calories providing virtually nothing but energy. The energy density of these refined carbohydrates contributes to obesity in two ways. First, we consume many more calories per unit of food. The fiber that's been removed from these foods is precisely what would have made us feel full and stop eating. Also, the flash flood of glucose causes insulin levels to spike, and then, once the cells have taken all that glucose out of circulation, drop precipitously, making us think we need to eat again. While the widespread acceleration of the Western diet has given us the instant gratification of sugar, in many people, especially those newly exposed to it, the speediness of this food overwhelms the ability of insulin to process it, leading to type 2 diabetes and all the other chronic diseases associated with metabolic syndrome. As one nutrition expert put it to me, we're in the middle of a national experiment in the mainlining of glucose. And don't forget the flood of fructose, which may represent an even greater evolutionary novelty, and therefore challenge to the human metabolism than all that glucose. It is probably no accident that rates of type 2 diabetes are lower among ethnic Europeans, who have had longer than other groups to accustom their metabolisms to fast-release refined carbohydrates, because their food environment changed first. To encounter such a diet for the first time, as when people accustomed to a more traditional diet come to America, or when fast food comes to them, delivers a shock to the system. This shock is what public health experts mean by the nutrition transition, and it can be deadly. So here, then, is the first momentous change in the Western diet that may help to explain why it makes some people so sick. Supplanting tested relationships to whole foods with which we co-evolved over many thousands of years, it asks our bodies now to relate to and deal with a very small handful of efficiently delivered nutrients that have been torn from their food context. Our ancient evolutionary relationship with the seeds of grasses and fruit of plants has given way abruptly to a rocky marriage with glucose and fructose. From complexity to simplicity. At every level, from the soil to the plate, the industrialization of the food chain has involved a process of chemical and biological simplification. It starts with industrial fertilizers, which grossly simplify the biochemistry of the soil. In the wake of Liebig's identification of the big three macronutrients that plants need to grow, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, NPK, and Fritz Haber's invention of a method for synthesizing nitrogen fertilizer from fossil fuels, agricultural soils began receiving large doses of the big three, but little else. Just like Liebig, whose focus on the macronutrients in the human diet failed to take account of the important role played by micronutrients, such as vitamins, Haber completely overlooked the importance of biological activity in the soil. The contribution to plant health of the complex underground ecosystem of soil microbes, earthworms, and mycorrhizal fungi. Harsh chemical fertilizers and pesticides depress or destroy this biological activity, forcing crops to subsist largely on a simple ration of NPK. Plants can live on this fast food diet of chemical fertilizers, but it leaves them more vulnerable to pests and diseases and appears to diminish their nutritional quality. It stands to reason that a chemically simplified soil would produce chemically simplified plants. Since the widespread adoption of chemical fertilizers in the 1950s, the nutritional quality of produce in America has declined substantially, according to figures gathered by the USDA, which has tracked the nutrient content of various crops since then. Some researchers blame this decline on the condition of the soil. Others cite the tendency of modern plant breeding, which has consistently been to select for industrial characteristics such as yield rather than nutritional quality. The next section will take up the trade-off between quality and quantity in industrial food. The trend towards simplification of our food continues up the chain. As we've seen, processing whole foods, refining, chemically preserving, canning, and freezing them depletes them of many nutrients, a few of which are then added back. B vitamins in refined flour, vitamins and minerals in breakfast cereal and bread. Fortifying processed foods with missing nutrients is surely better than leaving them out, but food science can add back only the small handful of nutrients that food science recognizes as important today. What is it overlooking? As the whole grain food synergy study suggests, science doesn't know nearly enough to compensate for everything that processing does to whole foods. We know how to break down a kernel of corn or grain of wheat into its chemical parts, but we have no idea how to put it back together again. Destroying complexity is a lot easier than creating it. Simplification of the food chain occurs at the level of species diversity, too. The astounding variety of foods on offer in today's supermarket obscures the fact that the actual number of species in the modern diet is shrinking. Thousands of plant and animal varieties have fallen out of commerce in the last century as industrial agriculture has focused its attentions on a small handful of high-yielding and usually patented varieties, with qualities that suited them to things like mechanical harvesting and processing. Half of all the broccoli grown commercially in America today is a single variety, Marathon, notable for its high yield. The overwhelming majority of the chickens raised for meat in America are the same hybrid, the Cornish cross. More than 99% of the turkeys are broad-breasted whites. With the rise of industrial agriculture, vast monocultures of a tiny group of plants, most of them cereal grains, have replaced the diversified farms that used to feed us. A century ago, the typical Iowa farm raised more than a dozen different plant and animal species. Cattle, chickens, corn, hogs, apples, hay, oats, potatoes, cherries, wheat, plums, grapes, and pears. Now it raises only two, corn and soybeans. This simplification of the agricultural landscape leads directly to the simplification of the diet, which is now to a remarkable extent dominated by, big surprise, corn and soybeans. You may not think you eat a lot of corn and soybeans, but you do. 75% of the vegetable oils in your diet come from soy, representing 20% of your daily calories, and more than half of the sweeteners you consume come from corn, representing around 7% of daily calories. Why corn and soy? Because these two plants are among nature's most efficient transformers of sunlight and chemical fertilizer into carbohydrate energy, in the case of corn, and fat and protein, in the case of soy. If you want to extract the maximum amount of macronutrients from the American farm belt, corn and soy are the crops to plant. It helps that the government pays farmers to grow corn and soy, subsidizing every bushel they produce. Most of the corn and soy crop winds up in the feed of our food animals, simplifying their diets in unhealthy ways, as we'll see, but much of the rest goes into processed foods. The business model of the modern food industry is organized around adding value to cheap raw materials. Its genius has been to figure out how to break these two big seeds down into their chemical building blocks and then reassemble them in myriad packaged food products. With the result that today, corn contributes 554 calories a day to America's per capita food supply, and soy another 257. Add wheat, 768 calories, and rice, 91, and you can see there isn't a whole lot of room left in the American stomach for any other foods. Today, these four crops account for two-thirds of the calories we eat. When you consider that humankind has historically consumed some 80,000 edible species, and that 3,000 of these have been in widespread use, this represents a radical simplification of the human diet. Why should this concern us? Because humans are omnivores, requiring somewhere between 50 and 100 different chemical compounds and elements in order to be healthy. It's hard to believe we're getting everything we need from a diet consisting largely of processed corn, soybeans, rice, and wheat. From quality to quantity. While industrial agriculture has made tremendous strides in coaxing macronutrients, calories from the land, it is becoming increasingly clear that these gains in food quantity have come at a cost to its quality. This probably shouldn't surprise us. Our food system has long devoted its energies to increasing yields and selling food as cheaply as possible. It would be too much to hope those goals could be achieved without sacrificing at least some of the nutritional quality of our food. As mentioned earlier, USDA figures show a decrease in the nutrient content of the 43 crops it has tracked since the 1950s. In one recent analysis, vitamin C declined by 20%, iron by 15%, riboflavin by 38%, calcium by 16%. Government figures from England tell a similar story. Declines since the 50s of 10% or more in levels of iron, zinc, calcium, and selenium across a range of food crops. To put this in more concrete terms, you now have to eat 3 apples to get the same amount of iron as you would have gotten from a single 1940 apple, and you'd have to eat several more slices of bread to get your recommended daily allowance of zinc than you would have a century ago. These examples come from a recent report entitled Still No Free Lunch, written by Brian Hallweil, a researcher for World Watch, and published by the Organic Center, a research institute established by the organic food industry. American agriculture's single-minded focus on increasing yields created a blind spot, Hallweil writes, where incremental erosion in the nutritional quality of our food has largely escaped the notice of scientists, government, and consumers. The result is the nutritional equivalent of inflation, such that we have to eat more to get the same amount of various essential nutrients. The fact that at least 30% of Americans have a diet deficient in vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, and magnesium surely owes more to eating processed foods full of empty calories than it does to lower levels of nutrients in the whole foods we aren't eating. Still, it doesn't help that the raw materials used in the manufacture of processed foods have declined in nutritional quality, or that when we are eating whole foods, we're getting substantially less nutrition per calorie than we used to. The news of declining nutrient levels in American produce prompted The Packer, a trade publication for the produce industry, to suggest that this might actually be good for business, because people would now need to eat more produce to get the same benefit. Nutritional inflation seems to have two principal causes: changes in the way we grow food and changes in the kinds of foods we grow. Hallweil cites a considerable body of research demonstrating that plants grown with industrial fertilizers are nutritionally inferior to the same varieties grown in organic soils. Why this should be so is uncertain, but there are several hypotheses. Crops grown with chemical fertilizers grow more quickly, giving them less time and opportunity to accumulate nutrients other than the big three, nutrients in which industrial soils are apt to be deficient anyway. Also, easy access to the major nutrients means that industrial crops develop smaller and shallower root systems than organically grown plants. Deeply rooted plants have access to more soil minerals. Biological activity in the soil almost certainly plays a role as well. The slow decomposition of organic matter releases a wide range of plant nutrients, no doubt including compounds science hasn't yet identified as important. Also, a biologically active soil will have more mycorrhizae, the soil fungi that live in symbiosis with plant roots, supplying the plants with minerals in exchange for a ration of sugar. In addition to these higher levels of minerals, organically grown crops have also been found to contain more phytochemicals. The various secondary compounds, including carotenoids and polyphenols, that plants produce in order to defend themselves from pests and diseases, many of which turn out to have important antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and other effects in humans. Because plants living on organic farms aren't sprayed with synthetic pesticides, they're forced to defend themselves, with the result that they tend to produce between 10% and 50% more defensive compounds than conventionally grown plants. Some combination of these environmental factors probably accounts for at least part of the decline in the nutritional quality of conventional crops. But genetics likely plays just as important a role. Very simply, we have been breeding crops for yield, not nutritional quality. And when you breed for one thing, you invariably sacrifice another. Hallwyl cites several studies demonstrating that when older crop varieties are grown side by side with modern cultivars, the older ones typically have lower yields but substantially higher nutrient levels. USDA researchers recently found that breeding to improve wheat varieties over the past 130 years, a period during which yields of grain per acre tripled, had reduced levels of iron by 28% and zinc and selenium by roughly a third. Similarly, milk from modern Holstein cows, in which breeders have managed to more than triple daily yield since 1950, has considerably less butterfat and other nutrients than that from older, less improved varieties like Jersey, Guernsey, and Brown Swiss. Clearly, the achievements of industrial agriculture have come at a cost. It can produce a great many more calories per acre, but each of those calories may supply less nutrition than it formerly did. And what has happened on the farm has happened in the food system as a whole, as industry has pursued the same general strategy of promoting quantity at the expense of quality. You don't need to spend much time in an American supermarket to figure out that this is a food system organized around the objective of selling large quantities of calories as cheaply as possible. Indeed, doing so has been official U.S. government policy since the mid-70s, when a sharp spike in food prices brought protesting housewives into the street and prompted the Nixon administration to adopt an ambitious, cheap food policy. Agricultural policies were rewritten to encourage farmers to plant crops like corn, soy, and wheat fence row to fence row, and it worked. Since 1980, American farmers have produced an average of 600 more calories per person per day. The price of food has fallen. Portion sizes have ballooned, and predictably, we're eating a whole lot more. At least 300 more calories a day than we consumed in 1985. What kinds of calories? Nearly a quarter of these additional calories come from added sugars, and most of that in the form of high-fructose corn syrup. Roughly another quarter from added fat, most of it in the form of soybean oil. 46% of them from grains, mostly refined, and the few calories left, 8%, from fruits and vegetables. The overwhelming majority of the calories Americans have added to their diets since 1985, 93% of them in the forms of sugars, fats, and mostly refined grains, supply lots of energy, but very little of anything else. A diet based on quantity rather than quality has ushered a new creature onto the world stage. The human being who manages to be both overfed and undernourished, two characteristics seldom found in the same body in the long natural history of our species. In most traditional diets, when calories are adequate, nutrient intake will usually be adequate as well. Indeed, many traditional diets are nutrient-rich and, at least compared to ours, calorie-poor. The Western diet has turned that relationship upside down. At a health clinic in Oakland, California, doctors report seeing overweight children suffering from old-time deficiency diseases such as rickets, long thought to have been consigned to history's dust heap in the developed world. But when children subsist on fast food rather than fresh fruits and vegetables, and drink more soda than milk, the old deficiency diseases return. Now, even in the obese. Bruce Ames, the renowned Berkeley biochemist, works with kids like this at Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland. He's convinced that our high-calorie, low-nutrient diet is responsible for many chronic diseases, including cancer. Ames has found that even subtle micronutrient deficiencies, far below the levels needed to produce acute deficiency diseases, can cause damage to DNA that may lead to cancer. Studying cultured human cells, he's found that deficiency of vitamins C, E, B12, B6, niacin, folic acid, iron, or zinc appears to mimic radiation by causing single and double-strand DNA breaks, oxidative lesions, or both. Precursors to cancer. This has serious implications, as half of the U.S. population may be deficient in at least one of these micronutrients. Most of the missing micronutrients are supplied by fruits and vegetables, of which only 20% of American children and 32% of adults eat the recommended 5 daily servings. The cellular mechanisms Ames has identified could explain why diets rich in fruits and vegetables seem to offer some protection against certain cancers. Ames also believes, though he hasn't yet proven it, that micronutrient deficiencies may contribute to obesity. His hypothesis is that a body starved of critical nutrients will keep eating in the hope of obtaining them. The absence of these nutrients from the diet may counteract the normal feeling of satiety after sufficient calories are eaten, and that such an unrelenting hunger may be a biological strategy for obtaining missing nutrients. If Ames is right, then a food system organized around quantity rather than quality has a destructive feedback loop built into it, such that the more low-quality food one eats, the more one wants to eat in a futile but highly profitable quest for the absent nutrient. From leaves to seeds. It's no coincidence that the small handful of plants we've come to rely on are grains. Soy is a legume. These crops are exceptionally efficient at transforming sunlight, fertilizer, air, and water into macronutrients, carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. These macronutrients in turn can be profitably converted into meat, dairy, and processed foods of every description. Also, the fact that they come in the form of durable seeds, which can be stored for long periods of time, means they can function as commodities as well as foods, making these crops particularly well adapted to the needs of industrial capitalism. The needs of the human eater are a very different matter, however. An oversupply of macronutrients, such as we now have, itself represents a serious threat to our health, as evidenced by soaring rates of obesity and diabetes. But, as the research of Bruce Ames and many others suggests, the undersupply of micronutrients may constitute a threat just as grave. Put in the most basic terms, we're eating a lot more seeds and a lot fewer leaves, as do the animals we depend on, a tectonic dietary shift, the full implications of which we are just now beginning to recognize. To borrow again the nutritionist's reductive vocabulary, leaves provide a host of critical micronutrients a body can't get from a diet of refined seeds. There are the antioxidants and phytochemicals. There is the fiber. And then there are the essential omega-3 fatty acids found in leaves, which some researchers believe will turn out to be the most crucial missing nutrient of all. Most people associate omega-3 fatty acids with fish, but fish get them originally from green plants, specifically algae, which is where they all originate. Alpha-linolenic acid is the omega-3 fatty acid found in all green plants. It is the most common fat in nature. Fish contain even more valuable long-chain forms of omega-3, like EPA and DHA, which they get from the algae in their food chain. Plant leaves produce these essential fatty acids. We say they're essential because our bodies can't produce them on their own as part of photosynthesis. They occupy the cell membranes of chloroplasts, helping them collect light. Seeds contain mainly another kind of essential fatty acid, omega-6, which serves as a store of energy for the developing seedling. These two types of polyunsaturated fats perform very different functions, in the plant as well as the plant eater. In describing their respective roles, I'm going to simplify the chemistry somewhat. For a more complete and fascinating account of the biochemistry of these fats and the story of their discovery, read Susan Alport's The Queen of Fats. Omega-3s appear to play an important role in neurological development and processing. The highest concentrations of omega-3 in humans are found in the tissues of the brain and the eyes. Visual acuity, befitting their role in photosynthesis, the permeability of cell walls, the metabolism of glucose, and the calming of inflammation. Omega-6s are involved in fat storage, which is what they do for the plant, the rigidity of cell walls, clotting, and the inflammation response. It helps to think of omega-3s as fleet and flexible, omega-6s as sturdy and slow. Because the two fatty acids compete with each other for space in cell membranes and for the attention of various enzymes, the ratio between omega-3s and omega-6s in the diet and in turn in our tissues may matter more than the absolute quantity of either fat. So, too much omega-6 may be just as much a problem as too little omega-3. And that might well be a problem for people eating a Western diet. As the basis of our diet is shifted from leaves to seeds, the ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s in our bodies has changed too. The same is true for most of our food animals, which industrial agriculture has taken off their accustomed diet of green plants and put on a richer diet of seeds. The result has been a marked decline in the amount of omega-3s in modern meat, dairy products, and eggs, and an increase in the amount of omega-6s. At the same time, modern food production practices have further diminished the omega-3s in our diet. Omega-3s, being less stable than omega-6s, spoil more readily, so our food system, focused on store food, has been strongly disposed against omega-3s long before we even knew what they were. Omega-3s weren't recognized as essential to the human diet until the 1980s, some time after nutritionism's blanket hostility to fat had already taken hold. For years, plant breeders have been unwittingly selecting for plants that produce fewer omega-3s because such crops don't spoil as quickly. Wild greens like purslane have substantially higher levels of omega-3s than most domesticated plants. Also, when food makers partially hydrogenate oils to render them more stable, it is the omega-3s that are eliminated. An executive from Frito-Lay told Susan Allport in no uncertain terms that because of their tendency to oxidize, omega-3s cannot be used in processed foods. Most of the official nutritional advice we've been getting since the